Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
WBUR.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The mantra of architect and green guru William McDonough is simple: eliminate waste, or as he puts it, waste is food. In his new book, Cradle to Cradle, he envisions a world where recycling is passé and products are designed to replenish rather than deplete. But is corporate America ready for a real green revolution? Are you? Why, William McDonough says yes. First, President Bush said it's not a perfect bill, but this week he signed a farm bill that will provide $190 billion in subsidies to U.S. agriculture. The bill reverses a Republican effort to wean American farmers from government funds and has infuriated U.S. trading partners abroad. Gerard Baker is Washington bureau chief for London's Financial Times. Earlier, I asked him to assess Europe's reaction to the huge U.S. farm subsidy.
Well, we should be careful, first of all, about and treat whatever the Europeans say with a large measure of detachment, because, of course, the Europeans are themselves the world champions at subsidizing agriculture, and I think the Europeans are themselves aware of that. But even allowing for that, the reaction in Europe has been extremely hostile, and understandably so. There has been an attempt in Europe, a limited one over the last few years, to limit farm subsidies, and there has obviously been a hope there that there would be the attempt to limit farm subsidies would continue in the US too. And I think the problem with the farm bill from the European perspective is that it's, instead of moving further towards a more of a free market in agricultural goods, actually turns the clock right back and takes us right back to a period where what we have dominating the global market in trade is government involvement. And I think there's mystification in Europe that an administration as conservative as this one, which is supposedly pro-free trade, anti-government subsidy, is completely going back on all of that, unveiling a huge subsidy, which I guess goes against the grain of what everybody thought the Bush administration stood for. And secondly, and much more worryingly from the European point of view, is that it opens the floodgates, really, to further subsidies. It's going to be very hard for those Europeans who want to limit subsidies, to do away with support for farmers in Europe. It's going to be very hard for them now to argue with the U.S. doing this, that Europe should actually go in the opposite direction and limit its subsidies. And it's going to be very hard for the rest of the world, too. It's going to make the prospects for free trade in agricultural goods that much harder. So there's outright alarm in Europe, I think it's fair to say, at this bill which the president is signing.
Has Europe expected the United States to lead the way? As you say, Europe has many agricultural subsidies of its own. So what was the role it was hoping the U.S. would play? Why doesn't Europe lead the way in this regard?
Right, good question. Europe, the major countries of the European Union, particularly the most sort of influential countries, France and Germany, are heavily affected by their farmers, by the farming lobby, and they have been very supportive of their farmers, and the whole common agricultural policy, which is the policy of the European Union that deals with agriculture, has been extremely pro-subsidy and extremely anti-free market, if you like. There had been some movement in Europe towards limiting those subsidies. There's a big debate on at the moment about the whole future of the common agricultural policy, and those countries, particularly, say, Britain, who have been very, very firmly in favor of doing away with subsidies and a complete radical overhaul of all of these policies in the European Union and elsewhere, they've been arguing vociferously for this and saying, look, other countries in the world are limiting subsidies, we've got to do the same. Now, the problem is that with the U.S. having gone the way that it's gone, it's very much harder for those free trade advocates, those people who are arguing for free markets in Europe, to make their case, because now the rest of the Europeans can turn around and say, well, look, the Americans are becoming even bigger subsidizers of their agriculture, so we've got to follow suit.
Where are we headed here with the steel tariffs that George Bush brought on recently, protecting U.S. steel, and now the farm bill subsidizing U.S. agriculture? Of course, Europe has subsidies and tariffs of its own. But as you say, is there a sense that the clock is being turned back, and what are the implications of that?
There is a sense that we are at a difficult moment here. And in fact, I think there's a growing sense of depression, probably isn't too far to put it, that on the trade front, we've probably passed the high watermark of free trade in the world when we had the agreement to establish the World Trade Organization, the successor to the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs of Trade, in the 1990s, in the mid-1990s. We then got things like China entering the WTO just last year. We really thought that the world was opening up much more radically towards free trade. Now, with the prospect of tariffs on steel, with the prospect of further subsidies for farming, with the prospect of further battles, frankly, between the US and the EU, who, remember, are by far the two largest single trading blocks in the world. They account for the largest amount of world trade, that we are looking quite depressingly at a future in which differences about trade, in which policies that take us further away from free trade are going to become the norm, rather than the steady progress that we had been making towards free trade over the last few years. That's going to seriously adversely affect relations between the US and the EU, which are already strained actually in political terms because of differences over the Middle East, differences over the war on terrorism. It really, without wishing to paint too bleak a picture, it does look really quite a lot like the US and the EU are drifting further and further apart, and it's going to get very hard to mend that rift.
And what about the other tier of economies looking on as the US and Europe fight over trade? What about the development cause here?
Again, this is another area where that what has been preached by the Bush administration, and indeed, to be fair, by the Europeans too, is not matched by what they are prepared to do themselves in practice. They're really not practicing what they preach. They have been saying, the Bush administration has said from day one, that it believes in trade, not aid, as the principal means of ensuring that the developing world can grow faster and can alleviate the terrible poverty that much of the less developed countries face, and that free trade, free open markets was the way to go. Obviously, the Bush administration has done some things through, for example, its attempts to get trade agreements from African nations, its attempts to get fast-track trade negotiating authority through the Congress. It's done some things which have been in line with that principle, but when it enacts massive subsidies like the Farm Bill or when it imposes tariffs on imported steel, it really does fly in the face of what it is telling the rest of the world they need to do in order to get their economic growth stronger, in order to alleviate the poverty in those countries. Then those countries are going to say, well, why on earth should we follow free trade policies? Because the United States doesn't. We've got no chance of getting into American agricultural markets because they're heavily subsidized. We're going to impose our own subsidies. We're going to impose our own tariffs. It really sets back the whole cause of trade, which actually the Bush administration is right about, that the way, in the end, the way to really address the problems of poverty in much of the world is to tear down the barriers to trade, is to open markets in the industrialized countries and in the rest of the world to free trade. And the Bush administration has been saying that's the right thing to do and doing something completely different.
Gerald Baker is Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. All right. Imagine a world where furniture upholstery is toxic-free and biodegradable, books are made of reusable polymers, and rooftops are covered with grass and trees. Sound like science fiction? It's already happening on a small but attention-getting scale. In his new book, Cradle to Cradle, architect and environmental visionary William McDonough says that businesses need to do away with the destructive cycle of cradle-to-grave manufacturing, where products go from assembly line to you to the dump, and embrace the regenerative power of green growth, where poisons are banished, nothing is wasted, and everything is used again and again. Some of the biggest names in corporate America have bought into the message. His clients include Ford, IBM, Nike, and Gap. What would happen if manufacturers model themselves on Mother Nature? Is eliminating waste a realistic goal or utopian ideal? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me from Charlottesville, Virginia, is William McDonough, founder and principal of William McDonough and Partners. He's author of Cradle to Cradle. Good evening and welcome, William McDonough.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Good to have you. Also joining us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
William McDonough, you are a much heralded green guy at this point, but you're not a traditional environmentalist as most of us understand that character. What's wrong with most environmentalism today?
Well, not that much, except that I think we have a much more hopeful approach from a design perspective than simply bemoaning the limits of human creativity. I think we're at a point in our history where we can look out and see the tragedies that we see in the environment and recognize that they're signals for action, not just a call to be less bad, and that as we see people saying we have to reduce our so-called ecological footprint because we're so damaging, that would make sense. But on the other hand, when you look at a planet that is essentially dominated by the human species, perhaps it's time to reverse this and leave behind larger human footprints, except we leave wetlands behind instead of asphalt. So we're taking an approach that simply says it's time for us to redesign design itself.
The how-to of that is the rub, is the point of it, I guess. Recycling has been something that many people have been part of now for a couple of decades as a contribution. You describe that as really insufficient.
Well, unfortunately, many of the things that we now, quote, recycle were never designed to be recycled. So we're forcing them through more lifetimes than they were ever designed for. And so the materials that are in them weren't necessarily there to be recycled. And that's why what we're really looking at is essentially a characteristic we call downcycling. When a milk jug is on its way to a park bench or a speed bump, it's simply slowing down on its way to the landfill. And it's still a cradle-to-grave typology. It's just losing quality as it goes through the process. And if it includes toxic materials such as heavy metals and so on, then those are abrading and going into our environment. And the whole system, I think, is ready for reexamination now that we've got information that we can use to redesign with.
So you describe this picture as consumers in America and around the world surrounding themselves with products that are at their core significantly toxic, using them, maybe recycling them once or twice, and then dispatching them to landfills, which are essentially big poison dumps where not much can ultimately be used very well. What's the alternative?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't be quite that shrill. I think that in terms of individual objects and things like that, we're not surrounding ourselves with pure toxins. That's for sure.
Well, not pure, I read in Cradle to Cradle the carcinogens in the clothes that we wear, the toxic heavy metals in the plastic of the water bottle we're drinking from, the polyester shirt that's toxic. It doesn't sound real encouraging.
It's ready for redesign, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I think what we're looking at is that in nature, waste equals food. There is no such thing as waste in nature. So we're not talking about eliminating waste. We're talking about eliminating the concept of waste. And I do this work with my co-author for the book, Michael Braungart, mm-hmm. who's a German chemist. We authored the book together, obviously. And he was the founder of Greenpeace chemistry section. And we started working together many years ago, and I've learned a lot about the ecotoxicity issues from Michael. And as we look at the possibility for design, the exciting thing is that we've found strategies to redesign almost everything we look at in ways that are ecologically intelligent and totally safe. So there's no reason not to do this except for some kind of positional conservatism that at some point will be seen as negligence.
And how far are we from companies embracing this kind of approach today?
Well, hopefully quite close. I think revolutions happen when 5% of a population gets up and says we're going to change. And I think we're seeing people, now that they're offered the opportunity for change, are recognizing that within this is a strategy of hope. Because when you see all the tragedies from an environmental perspective in the world, global warming, persistent toxification, endocrine disruption, heavy metal contamination, and so on, you realize that at this point in our history, we're essentially strategically tragic as a culture because we perpetuate these tragedies. And if we say they're not part of our plan, well, then they're part of our de facto plan because they're the thing that's happening because we have no plan. And so when you realize that you've become strategically tragic, you realize it's time for a strategy of change. And there's humility in this. And unfortunately, the word humility and design and architecture don't appear in the same paragraph very often since the Fountainhead. So if anybody has trouble with the idea of design humility, they just need to reflect on the fact that it took us 5,000 years to put wheels on our luggage.
But Jack Beatty, William McDonough is talking here about a tragic quality in the strategy today if we don't jump to a new track.
Well, I think he makes a very convincing case, and he makes it in an object, this book, that is an illustration of his principle. It's what he calls a technical nutrient. It's a book made of a special kind of plastic that can be recycled by the by the publishing industry to make other books, and it's a very it's beach reading because it's waterproof.
Book after book, we're talking with William McDonough tonight about the idea of cradle to cradle manufacturing, a cradle to cradle economy. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a new approach to manufacturing, to consumption, to the environment. Our guest tonight, William McDonough, author of Cradle to Cradle, calls it a cradle-to-cradle approach, that not cradle-to-grave, where products are made, perhaps they have toxics, they're used once and or twice or maybe even three times, but they end up useless in a dump, but a whole new approach to manufacturing, to conceiving products, to conceiving the buildings that we live and work in, that makes them endlessly recyclable, where there is no such thing as waste. What do you think? Is it time for a new industrial revolution, a green industrial revolution? Can we think our way out of environmental degradation? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. William McDonough, put some meat on the bones of this concept for us. Can you give us some concrete examples of new approaches, products, manufacturing approaches that would pull us out of what you call this destructive cycle?
Yes, in fact, our approach is now being applied at the level of the molecule, to the level of region and even country. At the molecular level, we've designed some new chemicals. We've designed new fabrics. I'll give you some quick examples. A new fabric we designed in Switzerland in 1993, where we looked at the chemical industry and said, let's put the filters of the future in our heads instead of on the ends of pipes. And let's have no more cancer, birth defects, mutagenic effects, teratogens, carcinogens, heavy metals, and so on. And we looked at 8,000 chemicals in the textile industry with these intellectual filters, and with that had to eliminate 7,962. We did the entire fabric line from 38 chemicals.
And you're saying that the 7,000 and some of it out of 8,000 were one way or another poisonous?
Either they were toxic or they were inappropriate.
Inappropriate meaning
they weren't necessary to the product.
Okay.
So we used 38 chemicals that were all completely vetted through these intellectual filters. And as a result, the water coming out of the mill, of textile mill, was as clean as the water going in, which is Swiss drinking water, sometimes even cleaner because the fabrics would further filter the water.
This from an industry that has destroyed countless rivers and streams around the world.
Exactly. So imagine being thirsty and you're looking at a dye vat and a mordant bath and a fixing bath and a rinse, and you'd rather drink that. What's interesting about that is that it means that the water coming out is clean as or cleaner than Swiss drinking water. That means you can turn the pipe around because you'd rather use it. It's more defined. And with no pipe coming out, there's nothing to inspect. So this product is completely unregulated. We see regulation as a signal of design failure. It's the state stepping in and saying, we've kept the right to kill. We've never gave it to industry. So we'll tell you at what rate you can dispense death. Our language betrays this concept. What do you say about someone who's meeting a regulation and not being punished? We say they're getting away with murder.
And yet right now, so much of environmental control in the United States and in Europe is based on regulation.
Right. That's why we're looking at the design approach, because it's much more effective for commerce. Commerce likes to move quickly, and I don't think anybody in the commercial sector would really get up in the morning and say that their interest was to toxify or do something really stupid. So we just provide alternatives to that. We developed a new polyester that's totally safe and infinitely reusable, and BASF Corporation, the chemical company, has now developed a new nylon 6 that is infinitely recyclable back to caprolactam, its raw material, and they have agreed to take it back forever. So we now have a product that will be a great technical nutrient for the future of the world's carpets, for example.
You talk about technical nutrients and biological nutrients. I want to be sure we bring these concepts to ground for our listeners. What some products you say would be biological nutrients. In other words, they would ultimately be broken down and even could be used to fertilize the soil. Others would be technical nutrients. What are these two categories?
Well, if waste equals food, then everything is a nutrient. If it's a nutrient, it belongs in a metabolism. So Michael and I have defined two fundamental metabolisms that humans can see. One would be the biological one, which is the earth and its natural systems that are alive. And the other would be what we call the technical metabolism, or the metabolism of human industry. The microphone in front of me, the TV set, your computer, and so on. And so products of consumption we call the biological nutrients, because you can truly consume them. Mm-hmm. They go back to soil. And we're losing soil at such a fierce rate worldwide, we need to rebuild our soil. So essentially, we see any material that can be designed to go back to soil safely is something that should. And then,
what sort of products might fall into that category?
Well, you know, a wrapper on an ice cream sandwich is not going to get cleaned and recycled. It would be a waste of energy, and it would never happen. So there's a product that, once it thaws, is totally useless. So that would be something that should biodegrade, you know, almost overnight.
And could it actually bring nutrients to the soil, or just become the equivalent of sand?
It could be anything we want it to be. If it's a biopolymer, we can make it starch, we can make it sugar, we can make it anything we want. And what's marvelous is we could also, you know, put a rare seed in it, so that we put a little sign on the thing that said, please litter.
We can understand that around wrappers. What else, what more significant, heavy, massive consumer products might turn into soil?
Well, anything that abrades or that you truly consume. So a tire on a car should be designed so that its particles, which might go to the soil, should become part of the soil safely and food for the organisms there. The soles of your shoes. Anything that you literally throw away. Mm-hmm. And because you're literally throwing it away. So you should think of it like a banana peel. Imagine, for example, in China, where if you take a train in China, there's no infrastructure there, so you end up with a bowl of noodles in a styrofoam bowl, and there's no place to put the bowl at the end of the meal, and they throw it out the window. Mm-hmm. They call it the white waste. Mm-hmm. Well, instead of sending everybody to training camps on how not to litter, which would be a social response, a design response would be to say, well, why don't we make those bowls out of the rice straw that they're now burning in the fields, causing a carbon problem, mm-hmm. and make bowls that are a biopolymer effectively out of that silicon carbohydrate, and then put a little nitrogen fertilizer in there as a kicker so that you could use it as a frisbee, and all the farmers are out there going, me, 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 me.
Let it fall on my land.
Yeah.
So there's the biological path, and that one is fairly intuitive. I had more trouble getting my thoughts around technical nutrients and how we take manufactured objects, computers, automobiles, and make them endlessly not waste. How do you do that?
Well, we call these products of service. If a product of consumption is truly consumed, it goes to soil. A product of service goes to a customer, not a consumer. How do you consume a TV set? I mean, if I took a typical television set and put it in front of you and I said, before I tell you what this does as a service, I want to tell you what it is, and you tell me if you want this in your house. It's 4,360 chemicals, contains toxic heavy metals, has an explosive glass tube, and we think you ought to put it at eye level with children and encourage them to play with it.
But does it have Gilligan's Island?
Right. What you want to do is watch television, not own hazardous waste. So what we're saying is you should be able to de-shop this thing. So when you finish with it, look at this. I mean, if you have a little laptop computer and you came to me and said, I've got my new computer, it's going to last me 25 years, I would say you're an idiot, because clearly what you want is the service of that machine. Mm-hmm. And within 3 or 4 years, you're going to want the service to be upgraded.
Okay.
And so what happens to those molecules? Right now, they're all bound together in some monstrous hybrid that can go nowhere but to a landfill or back to Asia, or into some kind of separation zone that sort of trashes the machine because there's no way to get it apart. We're saying that the manufacturers could design it for disassembly, and we're working with them to do that in many industries already, and it comes apart very simply, and all the materials are seen as technical nutrients of new computers and new cars and new shoes.
But when Sony or Panasonic comes and picks up my television and replaces it with the new one and my service goes on, what happens to those old parts that they take back?
That's the idea. They would be designed to go back through cycles, either for reuse or for reconstitution. But unless they're designed to come apart, you end up with this, a complex mush.
Jack,
so what we're looking at is how to put all the components together in a way that come apart carefully.
Jack Beatty, jump in here with us. We're looking at a world in which anything consumable biodegrades. I can fold it all into my garden, and things that don't are services that are taken apart and reused in a million new and different ways. Is this the brave new world, Jack?
Well, it would be great for the world, for the planet, if it were. I'm just having a hard time translating our current world to this one. For example, Mr. McDonough has worked with the Ford Motor Company on a $2 billion renovation of their River Rouge plant in Detroit. I've seen photographs of this, and there's a kind of garden on the roof, and there is it's an extraordinary looking building, and just doing that is a great achievement. It's a model for what people can use about a building that sort of lives with the environment, and it's a manufacturing facility of all things. But you know, while Bill Ford is commissioning that, he's also lobbying against raising CAFE standards, and he's producing a 6,000-pound, what is it called, Expedition, a veritable tank. Yes, it's great to have a nice building there, but if just the basic legislative and regulatory structures aren't there, will all this sort of micro work, company by company, really matter? Will it really matter if, for example, President Bush's voluntary global warming standards? I mean, he essentially has left this up to companies to work out some sort of system of voluntary compliance with gases. He tried that in Texas with pollution voluntary standards. And as soon as he left, they had to make them mandatory because they weren't working. So I guess, Mr. McDonough, my question is, if these big systems are just all wrong, Ford battering down the idea of raising CAFE standards. Exhaust standards. And the president with a non-policy, or one, as someone said, written by ExxonMobil on global warming, how can you make headway against that?
It's astonishing choreography, isn't it? The CAFE is on miles per gallon. That's mileage. You see, that shows the dilemma, because essentially the guardian, which is the government, is confused and finds itself having to regulate and then gets into all these debates about whether this regulation or that. The businesses want to be free to function. If you look at the whole CAFE debate, you know, the government's saying we need something, and certainly that's of grave concern. It's something worth addressing as a social enterprise, no question about that. On the other hand, the car companies are saying, well, fine, but let us, you know, don't just tell us what to do. Let us figure out what we can do, and we'll figure out, you know, how to make something realistic about it. So you end up with this strange paradoxical dilemma, neither of which is perfect. That's why I think the focus on design is so critical. What we're doing with the Rouge building is certainly interesting from the ecological design perspective, but we're also looking at the automobiles. And if you project out what our strategy would be in the world of automobiles, is that you would design a transition where we move from things that start to change and become free of all the things we're really concerned about that are urgently of concern, the toxins, dioxins, mm-hmm. and so on. Mm-hmm. And as we move into the whole energy flux, I think we're going to have some news for people quite soon to show a rather marvelous transformation that's simply being inspired by the design community in the world of cars.
You mean fuel cells, that sort of thing?
I'm talking about something actually different than that. I think we will end up with the hydrogen future. That's part of the design trajectory. It's not here today. We have a whole series of transitions that we need to go through. And there's a great deal of urgency in for us in doing this. And that's why we're approaching it so directly from the design perspective. I don't think the government's in a position to pull it off. I don't think the commerce and business as usual is going to pull it off. It's going to require an exciting, dramatic opening to new possibilities, and that's what we're starting to see. And so I'm quite excited about it, but that's my nature. I'm a designer and inherently optimistic.
We're talking about,
I look at vehicles. Let's take a look at the vehicle. If you took one of these vehicles that, you know, you can see from the moon and start to ask, you know, what are we doing driving these things around? And as long as you're focused on global warming and petrochemicals as the fuel source, and the materials are all questionable because they're all cradle to grave and everything's on its way to a landfill or incinerator, you know, this is a nightmarish vision. And it indeed is. And so what we're saying is, if these materials were all designed to go infinitely back into technical cycles, and if the fuels were all solar derived, because that's clearly has to be the agenda, then at a certain point, if you had a family with four kids, six kids, you want to go across the country, you have a large vehicle to do it, you know, all of a sudden you're driving around technical nutrients using sunlight. It's a whole different world.
There's no downside to the mega SUV that's made that way.
Well, except for, you know, its dimension on the roads against, you know, smaller vehicles and things like that.
Except
there are
the
certainly
factor.
A lot of issues involved. But I think the biggest issue from the car side for me is beyond the physical making of the cars, which have to go to technical and biological nutrients and solar-powered, no question, is actually that we only provide mobility for half the population because everybody under the age of 16 or over the age of 60 with bad eyesight has no mobility in this country. And so you end up with everybody driving around working for cars. And that, I think, is just as big an issue.
William McDonough, a lot of people want to join us. Let's turn to them. Benjamin is calling from Nellisford, Virginia. Welcome, Benjamin. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks a lot for taking my call.
Sure.
Thinking about this issue, it always seemed to me that the proper cost of each consumer item ought to include the cost of appropriate disposal. And if that was somehow mandated, then that would provide an encouragement for people to find the types of creative solutions you seem to be advocating.
Benjamin, thanks for the comment. And I guess there's a question there, too, but about the cost of disposal, the way things are currently made. What about the whole issue of cost, William McDonough? First of all, could we transition to this new era, hypothetically, by charging people the real cost of current products? But what about the future cost of your kind of products? It sounds expensive to have someone coming out and treating my TV as a service.
Two things there, actually three. To get to his question or point, indeed, where we have seen the costs being attached to the products, a great deal of discussion and human creativity is being brought to bear. Specifically in Europe, for example, there are end-of-life legislation protocols going right through the EU right now. The Germans have the Dual system, which is a recycling system that requires the packaging manufacturers to pay and either pay the public system that recycles the packaging, or they have to have their own system in place, one or the other. So, indeed, that does create a creative response. There's no doubt about that. As far as economics go, we're looking at the sustainable development concept here, and essentially we've been in a social market economy somewhere between pure capitalism and pure socialism, neither of which has been good for the environment. A pure capitalist will cut down the trees and forget the fish. A pure socialist will yield, as Alexei Yablokov will tell us, the former USSR that is now 16% uninhabitable. Mm. This would be the equivalent of putting a fence around Texas. It's called ecocide. And then you realize that there's a third ism, which would be ecologism, which might be just as dangerous when someone says, oh, it's only the environment that matters. Humanity doesn't matter. Economics don't matter.
Okay.
And those kinds of things are just as concerning because they're not realistic in the marketplace, which is the agency of change, the high-speed agency of change. And they're terrifying from a social perspective because when an environmentalist says that a child being born in India is a population problem, then human rights ceases to exist. So what we're trying to do is balance economy, equity, and ecology. So we tell our commercial clients, if it's not going to be profitable, don't do it, because they are a commercial actor. And if they're not profitable, they don't exist. If they don't exist, they can't change.
And is that a hurdle, or is it viable? Is your green way, can it be profitable?
The reason we're here and we're in business and we're successful is because what we do is immensely profitable for our clients. But let me give you an example. The Ford Rouge you mentioned, we spent $13 million over their normal budgets to put the habitat on the roof, 12 acres.
William McDonough, can you hold that example? We've got to take a short break. We want to hear about it. We're talking with William McDonough, author of Cradle to Cradle, about a new vision of how a green revolution might work. He puts it in terms of the next industrial revolution. What do you think? Is it time for a new industrial revolution, a green one? Can we let go of guilt and regulation and dive into green growth? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with author William McDonough, author of Cradle to Cradle. It's got a new vision of a green future. Can we think our way out of environmental degradation? Is this utopian or maybe the only way to go? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. William McDonough, I'm sorry I interrupted you, but you were talking about the significance of the Rouge plant, Ford's Rouge plant in Michigan.
Well, Ford Motor Company is a commercial entity, and they have shareholder value to create. And so our assignment from the chairman was to create shareholder value. Obviously, if we didn't do that, we weren't doing the job that anyone in a commercial enterprise would be engaged for. And so the fact that we were allowed to explore the edges of design from an ecological perspective and a social perspective as well as an economic one allowed us to come up with a strategy where we put a 12-acre habitat on the roof of the building. All the parking lots that where the cars go are all porous and filter water and hold it. It then goes through constructed wetlands, which filter the water using plants and trees and so on. And then it goes into swales, which are long hedgerow ditches of native habitats to attract back songbirds and so on its way to the River Rouge. So the water that hits that roof, if it doesn't just absorb and then evaporate and give free cooling to the building, it takes 3 days to get to the river. And when it gets there, that's, for all intents and purposes, clean. Now, that's a $13 million extra on a large project. But when you stop and look at it, Ford had a contingent liability under the Clean Water Act to put in stormwater systems on a brownfield. And the bill under conventional engineering was $48 million. So Ford figured we'd save them $35 million, and they got the landscape for free.
So
it didn't take very long to get it approved.
We filter the water through a forest on the roof, and we're off to a new world. Greg is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Greg. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you tonight?
Fine, thanks.
Good. My question is, we seem to live in a world that's driven by low-price competition, and the past, at least the past experience, has been that most environmental advances have occurred through regulation. You seem somewhat disdainful of regulation, but I was wondering, how do you see this future unfolding? Is this going to happen solely through the market, or is it going to happen through regulation or some combination of the market and regulation?
It's a great question. Thanks, Greg. William McDonough.
It is a great question. I think regulations are clearly an important signal from society that they don't want to be poisoned and they'd like to have a healthy world. And that's a totally legitimate act on the part of the Guardian. Commerce, I think, is interested in speed. It's interested in profit. And that's the nature of commerce. I think the two coming together are quite interesting. I think what we'll see from the regulator side, and we're already seeing it, now that the book is out, we've already been approached by a lot of regulators saying we would like to adopt this proactive approach. So instead of going to a textile mill and saying, oh, please reduce your cadmium to some threshold level, and in the end, yes, that product may be safe for some normal adult male, but it may not be safe for a child, and the whole system is still corrupt because we have this carcinogenic heavy metal moving through it. So they're looking at us and saying, well, wait a minute, if we could go to a textile mill and just simply say, hey, wait a minute, they've done it. Here's a product that's so safe you can eat it. Why can't you do that? Wouldn't that be marvelous? So what I think the regulators can do is transform into benchmarkers, and they can afford the time and have the purview to look at whole sectors of industry and say, these are the best practices we can find. Look, here's a mill in Switzerland with water clean enough to drink. Look, here's a shoe manufacturer that's identified every single molecule moving through their product, and they're all safe and defined. Look, here's a furniture company that's figured this out for design for disassembly and have worked with their supply chain.
How do we bring that all the way down to the floor of Walmart or Target, where they have very low price products from all over the world, where the environmental costs are spread over the entire planet? How do you bring this to bear on that kind of cornucopia of low price consumer products?
You're going to have to use the same tools that created the problem to solve the problem, but a different consciousness. And Einstein once said that no problem can be solved by the same consciousness that created it. The Walmarts of the world have succeeded because they've developed a more efficient delivery system and distribution system. And so you end up with this lowest common denominator across the board, as you mentioned. Well, if you actually take their mission and then define it as a design problem and then reestablish the parameters into which you work, you can actually use the same system to transform it into something we want at another level, which I think is pretty exciting. So, for example, if Walmart's mission is to provide, as they've stated, and as Sam Walton said before he died, what they want to do is provide the best possible products at the lowest possible price to the most people. Well, if that's your mission, then we have to define what does it mean to be the best of products. Do carcinogen-laden products represent the best we can do? At the lowest possible cost, well, what is cost? And how do you factor in all of these externalities or the costs of a persistently toxic environment or leukemia?
William McDonough, you've got the edge of an evangelist, and it sounds like a good thing. That's a big project, but we can imagine it. Kevin is on the line. Welcome, Kevin. You're on the air.
I was a bit skeptical in the beginning, but to tell you the truth, my question, I think, has pretty much been answered in the last response to the last two questions. I would have put the question in the slightly different terms, you know, the idea of external cost that you know, the parties to a particular market transaction, be it the buyer or the seller, they, you know, they're thinking about minimizing their particular costs. And the problem and where the role where I believe the regulator should come in is at that point where there's an external cost.
Does that mean bringing taxes into play on
possibly taxes? And I guess that's a better way of putting my question is the idea of a possible tax structure or some kind of regulatory means that would, in your idea, and it's kind of an open question because you have an open mind, which is it's got me going. But what kind of regulatory, let's say, to incorporate external cost in the actual market transaction to better give an incentive to both producer and consumer to take into consideration costs that they otherwise wouldn't take into consideration? Have you had any ideas of, you know, how to best approach that problem?
William McDonough.
My concern is that when we develop structural responses to structural issues, we further encapsulate and calcify the existing system because we're constantly reacting to it. And so we reinforce it with our very action. Let me give an example. If we simply tax something, we might be missing the opportunity for it to be redesigned because we're simply allowing the system to be perpetuated. They just have to pay a small fee, and now we keep getting cadmium. Or antimony and polyester.
But what if it was a tax that a green alternative didn't have to pay? Wouldn't competition then come into play to advantage and encourage the green product?
Yes, and so I'm not saying that it's necessarily a bad thing. I'm simply saying it's only going to be one of the tools.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the more exciting thing for me would be, for example, you know, that the cost actually does indicate success, and that ecological intelligence indicates success, and social grace and celebration represent success. Let me give an example. Right now, when you go out and buy a bottle of soap, a plastic jug full of liquid soap, you are getting polymer plastics full of dyes and additives and antioxidants and UV stabilizers and whatever from Cincinnati. It's in a cardboard box, it's full of water, and they're going to ship it from Cincinnati to you in Tucson. And they have to design it to work in Tucson because they have to design it to work anywhere in the country.
Mm.
So they have to do it for worst case. So you end up with a detergent that's designed to work in the hardest water in the country where you can walk on it. And then, but if it gets in Oregon where the water's so soft, it'll destroy the water. So you end up designing for the lowest common denominator. And you're shipping around water and plastic and cardboard. Now, if you take that young family in Tucson that's looking for the best product at the best possible price, what they really want is a product made in Tucson by their neighbors at the Tucson Soap Company that has zero packaging. It looks like an Oreo cookie. And we don't need to import water from Cincinnati. We don't need to pay for petrochemicals to drive water from Cincinnati. We don't need a cardboard box, which is destroying the trees in Indonesia. All we need is to wash clothes.
Mm.
Now, if the Walmart is selling an unpackaged soap that's conveniently available and it's made locally, and Walmart still makes 4 cents every time you wash your clothes, and Procter & Gamble still makes 4 cents every time you wash your clothes, and the people all of a sudden are getting their clothes washed for half the price, and the water chemistry is properly defined so we don't toxify our water courses, the only thing losing in that equation would be the petrochemical industry and the global warming industry.
Which, I want to bring
and the destruction of Indonesia. So, well, you know, fair play.
There's a fair number of beneficiaries. And the other way, Jack Beatty, are you ready to open a soap factory in Tucson?
Well, you know, I really think, Ms. McDonough, you're depending too much on the change of heart. I'm sure you talk to a lot of executives, and I'm sure they're far more ecologically conscious than I could ever be. But I wonder if that hasn't in some ways disturbed your perspective. You according to Business Week, you invited 60 chemical companies to join your project to make ecologically safe fabric, and all of them but one said no. That was telling you something. That,
well,
that
they
these people
all said no.
Okay. They all said no.
And then we went and visited with the chairman of one and explained what we were trying.
And you are persuasive.
And you are persuasive. But then you say that you want regulators to be benchmarkers, to say, hey, this is the best practice they're using in Europe. Why don't you use it? Well, let's play that back historically. If we had done that in 1970, say, and we hadn't had a Clean Water Act, we could go up to a business and say, you know, you are the Cuyahoga River is burning because your plant is polluting it. Why don't you do what they're doing in Europe, which is not sending flammable materials into the rivers? Why don't you do that? Well, we would have gotten nowhere. The rivers would still be polluted. We had to have a law. We had to have a regulation. It wasn't enough to benchmark. There had to be a cop on the beat.
Are you opposed to the cop on the beat, William McDonough?
Absolutely not. I think it's very clear that commercial actors should be completely and very clearly instructed that society is not interested in being murdered in slowly or quickly, and that it's really an untenable. These are untenable strategies. I think that it's a totally legitimate regulation. Mm-hmm. I think the issue would be, though, that rather than then sit here and debate what threshold levels we're going to allow, and how and play this little dance of death that we do back and forth, where mm-hmm. we don't really get anything done except waste a lot of people's time and produce you know, mediocre results, that we're looking for a revolutionary moment. And the reason I think businesses like it is because we are talking about the idea that you're free from regulation. And the only way to be free from regulation is if regulations exist. So I think the regulations are a critical part of the puzzle. I'm just saying that if they only make us engage in debate and they don't change anything. Because you see, what a lot of the regulations, the way they're dealt with today, is that people then say, okay, you want me to be less bad, I'll be less bad. And they measure their goodness by how their less badness. And the problem, it's ironic that in the English language, the double negative is a positive, because being less bad is not being good.
It's still
being
bad.
Bad, just less so.
William McDonough,
so we're saying, how can you be good?
You've got us hungering for that revolutionary moment. Ray is on the line. Welcome, Ray. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that I drive a car that's basically made out of recycled aluminum. It's the Honda Insight,
mm-hmm.
and I've had this car for about a year. I never thought I'd get a hybrid car, but I love it. And I think that people are willing to change, and I think that they're willing to pay a premium sometimes if they know that what they're buying is better for the environment and less destructive. And I think that you're seeing more and more of that. Organic food sections in supermarkets where people will pay double for a strawberry that is actually sweet instead of a strawberry that has no taste. And I think that, you know, when you go to the supermarket now, you can buy detergents that do not contain phosphates. And I think that there is awareness, but it's really incumbent upon corporations and governments to work together to generate more awareness.
But you're ready to make the change, Ray. William McDonough, we're almost out of time, but in 30 seconds, how pregnant with possibility do you see American society around this?
Well, I think it's one of these great moments when I think we're going to watch the creative forces that come at the time when some big changes are going on and marshal themselves around some kind of principle. This last century has been kind of brutish and strange if you look at the history of design. The only thing an environmentalist can say about modern design and modern industry is that if design is the first signal of human intention, from an ecological perspective, did we intend to measure our prosperity by how much of our natural capital we could cut down, bury, burn, and otherwise destroy? Did we intend to measure our progress by smokestacks? Did we intend to measure productivity by how few people are working? Did
we should
intend
hope
to require thousands of regulations?
William McDonough, I bet you could take that question string right on. You've got us thinking, and please keep your work going, because it is inspiring.
Enjoy the book. We're trying to make it exist, therefore it's possible.
Thanks for being with us tonight, William McDonough, author of Cradle to Cradle. And Jack Beatty, thank you for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.